All right, I'm with Frank Tortorich. Today is January the 13th, 2014. And Frank, we're going to be asking you some questions, and I want to thank you again for being part of this oral history project with the Amador County Historical Society. And I'll be asking you all sorts of questions. Feel free not to answer any of them. And we can always go out in whatever direction you want to go with this stuff. You know, it's all up to you and how we do things. First of all, what's your full name?
My legal name is, legal name is Francis Lawrence Tortorich, Jr.
Wow. I didn't know that. I'm glad to know that now.
It doesn't fit on any application you ever want. It, you know, they never give me enough line.
Oh, that's so
But funny. I've been known as Frank from my childhood.
Oh.
Frank Jr.
Do you know when that started?
Oh, at birth.
Oh,
my dad's name was Frank Lawrence Tortorich,
okay.
So I was named right after him. And then growing up, he was always Big Frankie, and I was Little Frankie. And he liked the name Frankie. Well, my dad was about 5'5",
mm-hmm.
and I grew up and I became bigger than Big Frankie, so Big Frankie and Little Frankie didn't fit anymore, and I never liked Frankie, so I took on the name Frank.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know all that. So you just had a birthday.
I did.
Yes,
75.
Wow, that's exciting. You're looking good, Frank. Of course, I've known you for a long, long time. You're one of the first people I met when I moved up here.
Yeah, I remember that.
30-some years ago.
I remember that in your bib overalls.
Oh, yeah. Back to you. you're married, and your wife's name is?
My wife's name is Mary Ann.
Okay. And how long have you guys been married?
We've been married, we're coming up on 36. It'll be 36 years in March.
Oh, that's great. And I'm going by the list of the questions I have here, Frank. So if I jump around, I apologize, but that's kind of the nature of
it. Go wherever you want.
Okay. First of all, I forgot to start my little watch. There we go. So you retired, and what was your previous occupation?
I was an educator in the California and the Amador County School District for 33 years. I was a teacher and then a principal and counselor at Independence High School and assistant superintendent of schools and principal of Plymouth Elementary.
So you knew the whole field of education because you were in every single...
I worked at all the levels.
Yeah.
I worked 1 year in Sacramento in the sixth grade. And then when I first started in Jackson in 62, I was teaching science. 6th, 7th, and 8th grade science, and it was a pretty brutal experience for a first-year teacher, and I didn't like it. I did that 2 years and didn't like that, but working with Robert Durrani, I told him I needed something different, and the math teacher was retiring, and I said, I want the math job. And so... the third year, I started teaching 7th and 8th grade math and physical education. And that I really enjoyed because, you know, one of my major minors is physical education. And so, and math was really a passion of mine. So I taught junior high, and then I moved up to the high school and I taught high school math and biology and elementary, junior high, physical education.
Was this with what school district? Then?
This was Jackson Union. Well, let's see. It was Jackson Union Unified School District, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
It started out as Jackson Union Elementary and Jackson Union High School, and then they closed several schools. They closed Aetna School, Milligan School, and merged them with Jackson Elementary and then Jackson High School. So that became Jackson Unified School District, and that was somewhere around 64
Oh, okay.
or something, somewhere in there. So Jackson Elementary grew. rapidly by incorporating those small schools.
So what years were you up in the high school?
I was up at Jackson High School. I was only up there 1 year, and that would have been around 65, 66, somewhere in that period.
All right. I have a question about that. I've been meaning to ask you a long time. When I was working to get my credential at Sac State, we had a young lady come down that was from Jackson, and she's talking about that everybody had to wear uniforms in Jackson. When you were teaching there, did students have to wear uniforms?
Gosh, when I went to high school there, the girls wore uniforms. I don't think they were wearing uniforms when I started teaching.
Okay.
I don't remember that.
I do know that we had a class discussion, and my professor at that time said that Jackson High School was the last public school in California to require uniforms. And I was just curious.
I don't remember. I remember that. I didn't know that that was a fact. But, you know, I'll tell you, I think most of the girls liked it because it didn't really affect the boys, but most of the girls liked it because they didn't have to worry about what they were going to wear. You know, it was a blue skirt and a blouse and then a sweater, and, you know, it was pretty easy. But then after the uniform thing went off, then there became, you know, a dress competition. You know, girls started dressing for other girls, you know.
Sure,
and,
yeah.
And I think the uniform was a good thing.
I know a lot of private schools have students do uniforms, and they swear by them, so I'm just curious. Now, you were a principal, you said, at several different levels?
Well, I had the unique opportunity in my career to do several firsts, and I had the opportunity to start Independence High School, and I was the first principal counselor there.
Now, that's the continuation high school.
The continuation high school. And at that time, it started out as a county-operated school. That's when we still had three small school districts. And that was the best job in education I ever had, working with the dropouts, the potential dropouts, the pregnant minor program. And I was able to do all the personal counseling with the kids. And it was a good fit for me.
So you also did counseling with the kids too?
I did a lot of counseling
with
the kids. Yeah. And we only had it fluctuated. Kids came and went as they graduated or moved on or something. But we went about 80 kids, 70, 80 kids most of the year round. Then
now you said county. So that means you got them from Jackson and then Argonaut.
And Ione.
And then Ione and Amador, right?
I mean. Yeah.
Okay. So you got them actually from three different school districts into the county.
Into the county.
Okay.
Well, then attending some meetings, and our funding was strictly by average daily attendance, ADA. That's the only money we got. Mm-hmm. And so we were operating on a shoestring most of the time. Then attending some conferences in continuation education, I was told that we would qualify for necessary small high school grant money, which would like double our income, but we had to affiliate with a unified school district. It couldn't be a county program. So I went over to Oro Madre and I talked to Ben Clark, who was the superintendent over there at the time, and I proposed that Oro Madre take over Independence High School, you know, as the administrator of it, and that, you know, we could double our funding. And Ben was very supportive of the idea. We made application, and Larry Ferdani, who was county superintendent of school, was supportive of the idea. So it was a perfect transition, and so we became part of the Oro Madre Unified School District, but serving the other two high schools, Ione and Jackson High School, at the same time.
Okay, interesting.
And then in 1982, when the county put a bond issue or a vote between the people of Amador County of unifying the whole county. And they gave them the option of unifying Ione and Jackson or all three school districts. And the people voted to unify all three school districts.
And that started in 83.
I think the vote was in 82,
right.
In November of 82, and then this took over in 83. And they, the new school board elected Ben Klotz as a superintendent of the new Amador County Unified School District. And they were recruiting John Grindy for the assistant superintendent's job. And John Grindy at that time was working over in Calaveras, and he was a good friend of mine. So he and I were having some meetings together, and he was asking me about the unification and all this type of thing, and I was filling him in. And I said, and the assumption was that John was going to be the assistant superintendent. And I said, John, when you become assistant superintendent, I would like to continue in the same capacity that I have now as principal of Independence High School. But at that time, I was also doing a lot of state-level work for the school district, both for continuation education and some other things. And I liked working with the state level. And he said, well, yeah, that's fine. But he says, why don't you apply for the assistant superintendent's job so you can tell the board that? And I said, well, John, I don't want to compete against you. He says, oh, that shouldn't be an issue at all. And, you know, I think you should apply, and that way you can tell the board what you're interested in, what your accomplishments. And I said, are you sure that's a good idea? Yes, yes, yes. So then I went and talked to Ben Klotz, and I told him about what John had said, and Ben said, oh, I think that's a good idea too. So, okay, so I went ahead and applied. And the night of the selection, it was like midnight, Ben Klotz called me and told me that I had been selected over John Grindy for the assistant superintendent of schools. And I said, you've got to be kidding me. And he said, no. And he said, do you want the job? And I said, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I mean, I wasn't in a mindset to say yes. Because I didn't think that's the way it was going to go. And I said, I don't know what's going on here, Ben. I said, what about John? And he says, the board voted, I think we had 7 on the board at that time, 4-3 for you. And he says, do you want the job? And I said, I don't know. I said, I need to think about this. And he said, the board needs a decision right now. I said, Ben, do you want me? And he goes, yes.
Yeah, there you go. Mm-hmm.
And I said, okay. Well, this was really kind of unnerving for me, you know, and I'm going, you know, wow, this is going to be pretty devastating to John, which it was. Mm-hmm. And it was going to be very difficult for me. Well, John being gracious, he called me in the morning and congratulated me, and I said, well, John, you know, I don't know what to say. I'm just absolutely, you know, blown away by this whole thing. There was a lot of controversy over this decision. There were a lot of people that were upset by it, and I can understand that fully. What I didn't understand were the people that got angry at me. And actually, some people just wouldn't talk to me. And some principals almost refused to work with me.
Really?
As if I was to blame.
Yeah.
You know, and I never understood that kind of thing. You know, I can understand people being upset, you know, because John, who was a good man and really deserved the job, in my opinion, he had the experience and the background, and I'd never worked at that level before, even though I had a lot of experience by this time. And so, you know, it was a difficult period of time for me to work in. I liked the curriculum development work that we did. I think I did some innovative things. I had teachers who were hesitant when I proposed the idea and later became supporters of what I was doing, and, yeah. And I understood that. Marianne told me, she said, that my problem was I was too far out in front of everybody, and, you know, go slow and let them catch up. And I guess I was a visionary in curriculum development, but it worked well.
Well, you helped me step out of the box. You helped me realize that there's more than just the books and the lectures, that there's a lot of hands-on type of history you can do. And hands-on is where it's at, and I know that. And you helped me get me to that point, so that's, I've always appreciated that.
Well, I appreciate your saying that. But then Ben retires, and they brought in a new superintendent, and he was going in a different direction, and he and I just did not work well together, and it was too political, and I just was not enjoying some of the really ugly politics that was going on. So I asked to be reassigned to Plymouth Elementary, which kind of blew a lot of people away. And then I finished my career at Plymouth Elementary, and I retired in 94.
Retired in 94. So and from start to finish in education, what were some of the things you saw that you liked that kind of went away? Is there anything you can think of?
Oh, gosh, that's a... I like the when you can have, when you don't get too big.
Yeah, right.
And when people can have interpersonal relationships with each other, and you're not numbers, but you're people. And I think when we unified and we doubled, you know, our school populations and our employee populations, I think some of that interpersonal thing was lost in that. And even though we're still on educational levels a relatively small school district for Amador County, we had grown so big. There were lots of teachers that were coming and going that I never really got to know very well when I was at the district office. I worked in personnel, which was both good and bad. It was a great experience, but at times it was very difficult, especially when I was involved with trying to, fire teachers or staff. That's always a difficult thing to go through. One of the things I prided myself on is that I think I counseled staff members into resigning rather than having to be fired, because I could guide them through the possibilities of how harmful it would be to them if we had to go through the dismissal process and they were dismissed, and what advantage it would be if they would resign. And I think some of them saw the wisdom in that, and they did. So I, financially, when you look at it just from dollars and cents, I think it made a lot of sense to unify in terms of putting together. Ione was going downhill. It probably was the greatest benefit to Ione than the other two school districts. Jackson definitely benefited. Ora Madre was the strongest financially, so I'm not sure it really helped them as much as it did the other two school districts. And of course, you know, after all these years, we still have some of the old timers that won't give up.
There you go.
So, you know, there was some pretty unpleasant things right at unification, some really angry things that people just did not want to give up their high school, especially when they merged Ione High School and Jackson High School. And the kids, in their wisdom, wanted to call it Jackson Ione High School, but the board had different ideas. And I can remember Ben Klotz and I talking to the board privately saying, don't change the name of the high school. Go with Jackson Ione. You're just going to create more unhappiness than already exists. And both of us told them that on more than one occasion. And they decided no. And their idea was, Ione lost their school. Jackson should lose their name. So, that logic never made any sense to me. Rather than trying to maintain identities, they were trying to eliminate them. And I think that was a mistake. And of course, it proved to be a hard transition for many, many people. And some of the board members came back to us later and said, well, you guys were right. We should not have changed it. But by that time, it was too late.
Right. I was at the high school when that took place, and the kids rallied, and they got together, and there was a list of names that they could have for high school, and overwhelmingly they wanted the Jackson Ione High School, J.I. High. And I remember when they were informed that it's been changed to Argonaut, that week was a real difficult week at school because the kids walked out a couple times, and it was a tough go.
Well, and I had parents attack me and blame me for not speaking up. And I said, I did speak up. I did talk to the board. Well, I never heard you say that. I said, I did that privately. They're my employer. I am not going to go publicly out and chastise my employer in public any more than you would your employer.
Right.
You know, but I let them know privately how I felt about it. So those were all difficult times to go through. But, you know, again, I had the opportunity of being Amador County's first assistant superintendent of schools, established a countywide curriculum development program that I thought was quite successful. They're probably not doing any of it anymore. I don't know what's going on. When I retired, I walked away from it all.
Yeah. Well, you kind of did and kind of didn't. You're still in education in some ways. let's talk about some of the things you did, you've been doing since you've retired. I know that you've been working on a couple books, some books, and a couple of them have been published. What are those?
Well, I had some opportunities to be kind of what I call at the right place at the right time, with the compatible interest. Marianne and I were married in 78, and I had done a lot of hiking and backpacking up in the Carson Pass area. Oh, gosh, since I was a little kid, actually. My dad took me up fishing at Carson Pass. And so I always knew about something about Kit Carson, which was most of it was wrong. But, you know, it was the history. And so when we were first married, we were having a neighborhood barbecue. And one of our neighbors was a man named Glenn Gottschall, who was the new ranger for the Amador Ranger District for the El Dorado National Forest. And he and I were talking. I asked him, I said, Glenn, what do you know about the Emigrant Trail? And he said he didn't know anything about it. What did I know? And I said, well, I knew kind of where it was and a little bit about it, but not much. And he said, why don't you sign up as a volunteer and do the historic research for us? And being a teacher at the time, and I was principal of Independence High School, but I had summer times off, and I thought, well, gosh, that sounds like a fun thing to do for a few years. And I said, what does that mean, you know, to be a volunteer? And he says, well, you come over to the office, we'll set you up with a desk, we'll give you a little budget to work on, and let you drive our vehicles, and, you know, go out and do your field research and whatever archival research you need to do. And I thought, gosh, that sounds like a blast. So Marianne and I did. We signed up, and at first I did just a lot of field research, going out and talking to old-timers who had been up in that country and hiking segments of it. In the 1930s and 40s, there was a group called the Silver Lake Campers Association who did put markers up on the old immigrant wagon trail. And so I was able to follow a lot of the trail there. A lot of those markers were gone, but there were enough there to be able to find it. And then I was learning from some of the old timers, some of the evidence that was on the ground, the rust rocks and the grooves and the ruts and this type of thing.
Now, what's a rust rock?
A rust rock is where a wagon wheel or thousands of wagon wheels rubs against a granite rock, and the slow-moving grinding polishes and smooths that rock, and it leaves iron oxide stains on it. Now, some rocks will smooth, but they won't show up with the iron oxide stain. Most granite rocks do. And other times, a wagon wheel will actually wear a groove into the rock. And at other times, the wagons and the animals cause a depression or an erosion that we refer to as a swale. And it's kind of a U-shaped depression in the ground. And you can follow those along. So those are the kinds of evidences that we looked for. As well as wagon part debris that from broken wagons or, you know, broke down wagons we find along the trail. So, you know, those were the things that I was learning about as time went on. Well, I did that for one summer, and then the following summer, the spring, Glenn, the district ranger, came to me and said, Frank, Washington, D.C. has issued a directive that all national forests are going to nominate two trails for National Recreation Trail designation, and the El Dorado is going to nominate the Pony Express and the Immigrant Trail. And I said, well, that's great. He says, I want you to write the nomination report for the Immigrant Trail. And I said, sure, what's the nomination report? And he says, well, here, I'll give you a sample. And he gave me a sample of a report that was written for a swamp in the southeast. And I'm going, Glenn, you know, this is for a swamp. This is, and he goes, it was like, oh, well, just follow the format, and where it says alligator, you put in mule deer kind of thing. Oh, okay. So they gave us some money for travel expenses, and Marianne and I went down to the Bancroft Library. We went to the Sacramento Archives and other libraries, UOP and around, just doing research on this immigrant trail, and we wrote a nomination report, and it was accepted. In the process of all of this, I was taking slides of the trail and what we were discovering, this type of thing, and started giving little talks to the Rotary Club and the Lions Club and the library, you know, and all this research I was doing and things we were discovering. And I was talking to Marianne, and I said, you know, this all started in 78. So by this time, it's like 80, 81, somewhere in that period. And I said, you know, Marianne, we're only studying 16 miles of a 2,000-mile piece of trail. We need to go back to Independence, Missouri, and connect all the dots and trace the trail all the way to California, Placerville. And so the year before, Marianne wrote to historical societies, libraries, museums, anything we could think to write to along the immigrant trail, hoping we'd get some information back. We got so much information back, we had to get a four-drawer file cabinet just to organize it and file it. including a letter from a lady in Kansas City saying there's a new organization being formed called the Oregon California Trail Association. How would you like to be charter members? Sure. So we sent off our dues, and our charter membership is hanging right up over there on the wall.
Yep, there it
to
is.
To the Oregon California Trail Association. And that was finally, that was all came about in 1984, 85, somewhere in there. And the Oregon California Trail Association holds a convention somewhere on the trail every year. And the first convention was held in Independence, Missouri, where the trail starts, and the next year in Oregon City, where the trail ended, because it was the Oregon Trail that was primarily the focus, even though the title was Oregon-California Trail. Well, we couldn't make those two because of my school commitments. But the third year, they moved the convention a little bit earlier into August. And so our third year, we attended the convention in Scotch Bluff, Nebraska. In between that, there was a group from California who was also scattered around the Bay Area mostly, who were involved in the charter and getting the organization growing. So a man named Tom Hunt called all of us California people together to form the California-Nevada chapter of the Oregon-California Trail Association. Actually, in the beginning, it was called the Nevada-California-Hawaii chapter because we had members who were living in Hawaii. And the Scotts Bluff Convention was in 85, and our chapter, who had not been formed officially yet, sponsored the convention in Carson City in 86. In 86 was when we organized the chapter, and I'm still not sure how this happened, but I was elected as the first president of the California Nevada chapter.
That's good.
And so I'm thinking, let's see, this is 86, and 78, I thought this would be fun to do for a couple of years. And as time went on, I got deeper and deeper involved in the Trail Association. I started doing a lot more preservation work, a lot more research. I started writing some articles, giving a lot of talks.
You sure got a lot of words over there.
The Oregon California Trails Association gives out annual awards, and one of their awards is called the Merrill Mattis Excellence in Writing Award, which I never ever thought I'd ever have a chance to get, because I consider myself a researcher but not a writer. And a friend of mine and I were, Jim Carman and I were doing research on the Big Tree Carson Valley Wagon Road, and we decided to, and I gave a talk at one of our conventions on this. And the editor of the Overland Journal, the old OJ, said, would I submit that as an article for the Overland Journal? Well, this is a very scholarly magazine. And so I asked Jim Carman if he would co-author that for us. And so we submitted it, and it was accepted, and it was published in the Overland Journal. And it comes out four times a year, and at every convention, they give an award for Writer of the Year Award, the Merrill Mattis Writer of the Year Award. And those are always awarded at the awards banquet. And the awards banquet is a little pricey. This one year, what was it? It was in 2005. We had gone to the convention. I don't remember where it was. It was in Salt Lake City. And I wasn't going to go to the banquet. And I was in the book room, and Bob Clark said, "Congratulations." And I said, "For what?" And he said, "Didn't anybody tell you? But you're the recipient. You and Jim Carman are the recipients of the Merrill Mattis Award." I said, "You got to be kidding me." You know, and for our Victory Road. So
good thing you ran into him.
So unfortunately, Jim Carman had passed away that previous, April or something like that. There he is right there. And so he saw the article published, but he never knew that he won an award for it. And so, you know, I was so humbled when I accepted it, and I really meant it. I said that I figured, this is what I told acceptance talk, that I figured I had a better chance of getting Woman of the Year Award than Writer of the Year Award. that was completely out of my mind, and so I really cherished that particular award. The other one that I received that blew me away was this past August in Oregon City. And it's Okta's highest award, called the Meritorious Achievement Award. And it's, you know, and I've watched some of the biggies in the Trail Association get that award. And that was another one that I'll never get that award, you know. And we were up at Oregon City at the awards banquet, and unbeknownst to me, the awards committee had contacted Mary Ann and asked for some background information on me, because I was up for an award. She didn't know what award. Mm-hmm. And so she sent them, but I was not to be told. And so we're up at the banquet, and they're giving out the awards, and of course the last award to be given is the Meritorious Achievement Award. It's called the Greg Francois Award. And Greg Francois was one of the founders of the organization and a very good friend of mine who has since passed away. And he's a great author and a publisher, and I wish he was still around. I need his help. So when they were introducing the award, I'm looking around the room thinking about some of the biggies over there. Oh, that person probably is going to have, you know, this one over here. You know. And when they finally announced my name, I didn't recognize who they had announced. I'm honest, this is the truth. And I sat there for a few minutes going, Mary Ann said, "It's you." And now I went, "Whoa." Well, of course, I was just completely blown away. And as I was approaching the podium and they're still announcing, you know, my credits, I got a standing ovation.
Wow.
Well,
that's huge.
I was not only in tears, but I was totally at a loss for words.
Yeah, that's huge.
And I just, to this day, it's very emotional, to have those kind of recognitions. Because I did what I love doing, helping preserve the trail. You know, I guess I'm addicted to it.
Oh, you're very passionate about it. It shows.
And, you know, I received another award that I received was the Outstanding Educator Award when I was teaching adult education classes on the Westward Migration and the California history. Marianne and I also received together a Lifetime Achievement Award from the chapter for our work. Marianne received the Elaine McNabby Award for Volunteer of the Year. Did you shut that off?
I did not.
Oh.
I'm just moving it just because okay. Your back was turned.
And so the special part of all this for me has been that Marianne has been my partner and enjoys the trail as much as I do, I think. She has just done some wonderful stuff for the organization. She is probably one of the foremost authorities on putting on the national convention.
That's a lot of work.
It's a lot of work. She's written a convention planning manual that has been used by many people. So anyway, it's when I retired, this is what I retired to. People were saying, well, what are you going to do? Well, I had no problem of knowing what I was going to do. When I retired in 94, my first project was to finish writing a book that I had started called The Gold Rush Trail. And what was the reason this book came about was because I was doing a lot of tours on the immigrant trail from, from, say, Woodford's and out on the desert all the way to Placerville and driving from point to point. And people were saying, well, if people don't go with you, how are they going to be able to see the trail? So I decided to write a historic guidebook. And along 33 miles of Highway 88, starting at Woodford's and ending at the old Iron Mountain ski area right off of 88, what is now called the Mormon Immigrant Trail. And that book, when we first published it, we published it ourselves, and a Motherlode Printing here in Jackson printed it for us. I thought, well, it's a financial investment, and let's only do 500 copies. And Marianne and Barry both said, no, you should do 1,000. So we did 1,000. It was about $2,700 for the 1,000 copies. Sold out in 14 months. And so that book is now in its fifth printing.
Wow.
Or getting ready. It's finishing up the fourth. We're ready to go into the fifth printing. And I don't even market it. I sell it at a few locations locally, Carson Pass, Sorensen's Resort, museums over in Markleyville in Nevada, and Heinen Book Company locally. But I don't really market the book at all. But that didn't cover the 16-mile section of trail that I was originally studying back for the nomination report. And that goes from Caples Lake up through the wilderness and all the way back over to Tragedy Spring. And so I had to write the hiking to Gold Rush Trail. And that book is in its second printing. That came a few years later. It's in its second printing. It's not as widely sold as the other one, because the other one is right on the highway, and the hiking guide obviously is like a backpack trip. Mm-hmm. I've had a lot of people help me over the years do this kind of thing. Just most recently I completed a book on Snowshoe Thompson. This is a book that I'd rather not publish myself, because it's a where these other two books were less than 90 pages, this book is about 285 pages and has over 350 footnotes in it. So it's a more scholarly book.
Yeah, a lot of research.
With a lot of photographs and stuff in it. And so I'm looking for a publisher, which is not an easy process. So I'm getting a lot of advice from people on ways to go. But,
Well, now, why did you pick Snowshoe Thompson?
Well, there's a location up in just near Hope Valley that is, local legend has it, it's Snowshoe Thompson's cave. Snowshoe Thompson was Norwegian, and he came to California to the Gold Rush in 1850, 51, somewhere in there, and was not successful, and answered an ad in a newspaper, which we've never been able to find that ad. As you well know, you helped me do some research on that. That they were needing somebody to carry the mail between Placerville and Genoa during the wintertime. Well, Thompson, having grown up in Norway, was born on skis. They called them snow skates. The translation is snow skates there. And in the early days, they were called snowshoes in California. Nobody had ever seen this type before. So when he came up with this design, they called him snowshoes because he wore them on his feet. So he made a pair of these 9 or 10 foot oak skis and went and applied for the job. And the postmaster said that, you know, that he's crazy, you know, that people have tried it. It would take weeks and weeks to get over. Most of them got frostbite. Some of them turned back. Others that made it through were nearly dead. And Thompson, whether he demonstrated or not, convinced him that he could do this. So in January of 1856, Thompson took his first mail bag, headed for Genoa. In 3 days, he was in Genoa, and 2 more days, he was back in Placerville. And nobody could believe it. But the mail was proof that he had done that. Well, of course, you know, he just created a sensation almost immediately. He continued to do this for 20 years.
Is this all year long? Or just
no, just, well,
during the snow?
Primarily during the winter time when the snow was on the ground. But later on, he did do a little bit of it. He established some wagon delivery and back and forth across the mountains. So, but there were other people who had the mail delivery contracts. Thompson got caught up in a lot of politics and stuff, and he was not hired. Technically, he was not hired by the Postal Service, but he was hired by a contractor. In those days, there were the post offices, and then there were the contractors who delivered the mail. And the postal system didn't do that. They contracted those out. And a man named George Chorpenning held that contract. And he always had financial difficulties. So technically, Thompson was working for Chorpenning. Well, Chorpenning couldn't pay his own bills, let alone Thompson. But Thompson was very civic-minded, so he continued delivering the mail because of the need for it. And anyway, long story short, he was never paid for his efforts. And I became fascinated with the story of the man and how he made a living and where he came from. And at the urging of a lot of people, said to write a story. There were a lot of things written on Snowshoe Thompson. A lot of it was incorrect. Some of it was myth. And so I think in my book, I've been able to solve the problem of why he wasn't paid and what little pay he did, how much that was, where he lived, when he got married, and all this type of thing.
Physically, can you describe the guy?
Well, from what I understand, he was about 6 feet tall. He was lean and wiry. He had what I believe to be the Norwegian metabolism because he never suffered from the cold. And where most Europeans who were out here, Americans, were suffering from the cold severely, and he never seemed to suffer from the cold. And I think there's something about the genetics of where you're raised. You know, I have not done the research on that, but he never ever had a problem with frostbite. He would travel through storms. He talked about at times when he couldn't travel because of the blizzard, he would stand on a windblown rock and dance all night to keep warm. or he would, he found out that in a tree well, it was much warmer than out exposed, so sometimes he would get down into a tree well just to get out of the elements. But, you know, it was nobody's ever been able to even replicate that feat since Thompson did it. And he was doing it on pretty crude snowshoes or skis.
You know, Frank, I'm supposed to take a break at 55 minutes. It's now 51 minutes.
Okay.
We're going to take a break right now.
Sure. Am I rambling too much?
No. Well, break.
Break.
Well, Frank, we're over the break.
Break, we're over Frank.
Hey, got some really good information about what you've been doing once you retired and stuff, and I know we could go into that in greater detail. However, I'm interested in where you were born, where you grew up as a kid, and what brought you guys, you and your family, to Amador County?
Well, my dad was born in New Orleans in 1911. And he grew up in New Orleans, but every summer he went to a small town to stay with his grandmother, a little town called Lecha. They pronounce it Lecha, but it's spelled Lecher.
Oh, really?
Yeah, E-R. But that's how the Southerners do it. Anyway, when he was about 14 or 15 or some, and not knowing exactly why, I have my suspicions, but the family moved to Sacramento. And so my dad went to Sacramento High School, and my mother was born and raised in Sacramento, even though she lived, her father worked for Southern Pacific, and they lived in Arizona for a while, and then back in Sacramento, and my mom and dad met, I think, at a dance. And they were married in 1934. My dad went to Barber College and was in business with his father for a while.
Now, where was the Barber College at?
In Sacramento.
Sacramento.
Moeller Barber College. Mm-hmm. In fact, it may still be there. I don't know. It was there. It used to be like on J Street or somewhere. Mm-hmm. It may not be there anymore, I don't know. And during the Depression, my dad did quite well. He worked for a couple of barbershops, but he also worked for the Senator Hotel. Hmm. And he was only working 3 days a week, but making pretty good money for the Depression years. And people kind of feel sorry for him because he wasn't working full time, but he was doing better than most. But he wanted a small town atmosphere. And so he contacted the barber union and found out that there was a request for a barber in Jackson at Valvo's Barbershop. My dad came up and interviewed, and they hired him. So my sister was born about the same time, so I think it was 1936 when they moved to Jackson. And, of course, you have to remember during the Depression what Jackson was like. The mines were going full blast. There was gambling in Jackson. The bordellos were in full operation. And Jackson was a booming community and really not suffering the Depression at all. Like so many other places did. If you read the papers, you'll see these long lines of people waiting to be hired at the mines. Well, those weren't the locals. Those were people coming out of Stockton and the Valley, but the newspapers didn't recognize the fact that these were people from from out of the county looking for employment. So they assumed that there was a great suffering in Amador County as well, which wasn't true for the most part. So anyway, Jackson, there were I think four or five barbershops in Jackson at that time. There were 19 bars and casinos going 24/7. So Jackson was a really booming place. At that time, they first moved into a little house right there on North Main and the hill that goes up to the elementary school. I don't remember the name of that street. We're right behind where Bob Campbell's house.
Peak?
No, that's not Peak.
Oh, Bob Campbell's.
Bob Campbell, yeah. Right there on North Main and that street that goes up to the elementary school. Anyway, they lived there, and then later they moved to a house on Stacel Avenue.
Which is right there. It's right close to it.
Yeah, right close to it, around the corner.
Yeah.
And then in 1939, in January 8th of 1939, I was born. And I always say I was born in Jackson, but technically I wasn't, because they made the midnight ride down to Sacramento when I was born in the Mercy Hospital, and which most kids were. They were either born at home or they were born in Sacramento. So I was physically born in Sacramento, but my parents were living here. So I always just say I was born in Jackson. And then in 42, after the war broke out, the mines closed. And so Jackson just went into the real dump, and people were going off to the war, and jobs were being lost. And so my dad took the family, and we moved to Vallejo first, and he worked in a barbershop. And then his brother-in-law told him about getting a work with the shipyards, and he could make lots more money. So we moved to Alameda. And we lived in Alameda until the war ended. And then in 46, we moved back to Amador County, again on Stacel Street. But we moved into the house where Bob and Pat Works live. Mm-hmm. And we lived in that house, and that's where I grew up. I went to, my sister and I both went to Jackson Elementary School. We could just walk around the corner. And, of course, when we started in school, it was the old two-towered building, two stories with a few little outbuildings. And time went on, by about the fourth grade or so, they started building the new elementary school. So my class that graduated from elementary school in 53 was the first class to graduate from the newly completed elementary school.
Oh, wow.
So another first.
There you go.
Right. And then, of course, then I went to Jackson High School. I can remember Main Street very well in those days, in the 40s, and how bustling it was. Everything came back to life after the war. Mm-hmm.
So things picked up with the exception of the mines, right?
Yeah, except the mines. Now, the Central Eureka reopened, but the Argonaut and the Kennedy never did reopen. So some of the smaller mines did. But Jackson started booming. At that time, the whole county was around 7,000 people. And Jackson itself was about 1,100 or 1,200. Hmm. So our schools were small. But I remember our basketball games, the high school basketball games, were all played in the Krabanoff Hall, which is right above the Heinen Company bookstore.
Right.
And there was a big auditorium up there. It had a balcony around it. It had a big stage. And that was a community center. And basketball games were held there. Dances were held there. Concerts were held there. I remember every New Year's, several organizations got together and had a big New Year's Eve party there. And then in 52, I believe, they built the new addition to Jackson High School and the gymnasium, and then built the field up there. So all the athletics then moved up there. And so by the time I got to high school in September of 53, we had the new facilities. I participated in four sports initially. I played tennis. I played basketball. I played football, and I ran track. As I started to excel in track and pole vaulting, I dropped the tennis and the basketball, and concentrated on pole vaulting and football. And I became quite successful in pole vaulting. I was undefeated in Mother Lode League for 3 years. I set all the records for Mother Lode League except one. My junior year, I was ranked the 13th best vaulter in the state.
Wow.
And my senior year, the 17th best vaulter in the state. I never made it to the state track meet championships, because we took three people from our conference, and number one and two in the state were from my conference.
Funny.
When I went to Sac City College to pole vault, I was the fourth best vaulter in the conference. I didn't make the team because the first three were in my school. Those were times when I was in the wrong place,
yeah.
You know. I never got much taller than 5'7.5" or something, and all these guys were getting taller and bigger and faster and stronger, and so my pole vaulting days were minimal. I went to Chico State for a year and a half, partied a lot, had a lot of fun, and then in 1960, I married Donna Calais, and moved to Sacramento and went to Sacramento State. And got my teaching credential and started teaching at Jackson Elementary in 1962. Donna and I had two children, and that we raised in Jackson, and then we separated in 76, and then in 78, I married Mary Ann. So
children,
and of course my two children, Michael and Deanne, grew up. Deanne is a speech pathologist now for the school district. She has two children. Her son Tyler is a civil engineer working for a firm in Roseville. Alyssa is a teacher for the visually impaired for the school district, and she has a baby. My son Michael went to school as an electronics technician and worked for McClellan Field until they closed, and he is now working for the Rancheria, the Jackson Casino Rancheria, working in the some kind of a, I don't know if it's a supervisor or a position in their maintenance department for the Rancheria, not the casino part. And they have a daughter who is a senior in high school and going to go off to college in the fall. So,
great.
Yeah. So anyway, that kind of is I've had opportunities to leave Avenor County on a number of occasions. I've had job offers at other places, but I have lived. I went to school in Ohio. I went to school in Tennessee. I lived in San Jose, Sacramento, and I'm just not of the city bent. I'm a mountain man. And when Jackson put in the traffic signal down at 49 and 88, I told Marianne, we're out of here. So we moved to Pine Grove, and then they put a traffic signal in Pine Grove, and she said, are we moving? I said, no. We get just enough snow to make it annoying. I'm not going higher. So we've been here since 95. So
that's
anyway.
You remember special friends growing up here in Jackson?
Oh, you know, most of my friends are either dead or have moved away, growing up with. Rich Rose, who was I played with as a youngster, a lot, is living in Rancho Cordova. In Rancho Murrieta, Slough House. And he taught with me. We both started at the same time teaching in Jackson in 62. And then he went up to the high school, and then eventually he went down to Cordova and taught down there. And his son went on to play some professional baseball. My friend Louis Ianni, who I grew up with, just passed away. He worked for Caltrans and lived over in Markleyville for a long time. Some of them are, there's a few locals that are still here that there are friends, but we're not close friends.
Sure.
Most of my friends are either former teachers or teachers that I worked with, like yourself, or people that we associate with church. And then, of course, a lot of our friends are with the Trails Association. Which we're still deeply involved with. Our chapter is going to sponsor the convention, our annual at South Lake Tahoe in 2015. So we're in the process of working on that. I'm in the process of preparing a couple of lectures coming up. One for the Nevada Sesquicentennial. And that'll be up at Incline Village in March 2014. And then another one for the Daughters of the American Revolution, I think on their annual state meeting. And they want a talk on the early days of California, the Boston ships, and some of that type of thing. What was life like in California at that time? So I'm working on those two things.
How fun. See, you're always in demand, Frank.
Well, I don't know about that. It looks like one of the things that has been nice is that I've been hired by Sorensen's Resort to do tours for their guests during the summertime. So I'll do about three of those this summer. And then Wally's Resort over by Genoa wants me to do some programs for them over there during the summertime. And so all of those are fun to do, and they yield a little bit of money, and so that's always nice to pay my expenses, and we have fun doing that. I'm also working for the Forest Service. I have this terrible job that I have up at Carson Pass, where I have to work with the visitors. I have to talk history. I have to walk out on the trail and look at the wildflowers, and it just... It's just a strain, but...
Yeah, that's why you're smiling.
it's pretty nice.
Get back to this a little bit. Do you remember any special teachers in school that...
Growing up, that were my teachers?
Yeah.
Oh, gosh, yeah. Probably the one teacher who had the greatest influence on me was Fred Lefevre.
Oh, I know Fred, or knew Fred.
And the curious thing about it, I spent 33 years as an educator, but growing up in schools, I hated school. I can remember the first day of the first grade in Alameda, my mother took me to school, settled me in school, then she went shopping. When she got home, I was back home sitting on the step waiting for her. She said, "What are you doing here?" I said, "I don't like it, I quit." And that was my first day of first grade. They didn't have kindergarten in Alameda right after the war, towards the end of the war there. And then I never really liked school. I was not... I wasn't a bad kid. I didn't cause trouble in school, but I just never seemed to like school. And, you know, I was okay. I would say I was probably, on the most part, a C student. I struggled with spelling, was probably my biggest difficulty, which I still have problems with today, because I'm a phonetic speller. Spelling, I always said, if phonics is so great, why doesn't it start with an F? You know, that type of thing. And spell check is wonderful. My wife is a great editor. But, you know, I went on and got a master's degree, but I struggled with the English language and its inconsistencies. But what I did migrate to were the math and sciences and PE, of course. And I can remember they thought I had a reading problem when I was in school, especially in the 7th and 8th grade. And I was always put in the remedial reading classes. And I never understood this because, to me, I never had a problem reading. Well, what I realized in later years is I'm a terrible oral reader.
Oh.
And I stumble over the words, or my eyes jump ahead or do something. And so when I read orally, I struggle. And so they were assuming that I was a poor reader. When in reality, I was not a poor reader. I was a poor oral reader. And nobody ever picked that up. I figured that out on my own one day.
There is a difference.
And I'm going, wait a minute, that's the problem. And so I think that was part of my frustration in school, is that they thought I was a poor reader. And I'm going, I don't have a problem reading. And I can remember, in the eighth grade, my eighth grade teacher went around as we were graduating, and which I thought was a brutal thing to do, and went around and told every student whether they should take general math or algebra. And when he got to me, he said general math. Well, I can be a bit hard-headed. I'm thinking to myself, no way am I taking general math. I'm taking algebra. Well, I went into algebra, and of course Fred Lefevre was a teacher, and Fred and I clicked, and I loved algebra, and I did really well in algebra, went on to take, geometry, loved geometry, took algebra 2 and trigonometry, and even went on my own with Fred as the only student, taking some pre-calculus and solid geometry. Well, nobody else in high school was doing that. And Fred was a great influence. He was also my high school track coach,
right.
my pole vault coach, and became my friend. And then it was such a thrill when I came back to teach, and I was teaching math, and then Fred and I were colleagues.
No, that's nice.
So, yeah. Yeah. And he and I would go to track meets together and watch the big boys, the Olympic stars, and you know, so you know, we maintained that friendship for the longest time. Who else? I had a lot of good teachers. Fran Vira was a good teacher. He probably was one of my. I was going to be an industrial arts teacher, and I took quite a few classes from Fran. In shop and drafting and that type of thing. And that's one reason why I went to Chico State, was because they had a good industrial arts department up there. And that's one of my minors. I have 4 minors and 2 majors. I have a minor in industrial arts. I have almost a major in PE. I lacked one course, but I've got like a 45-unit PE minor.
In most cases, that's a major.
Well, it is. If I had taken kinesiology, I would have had a major. That was the only class I didn't have that would have qualified. And then I have a minor in science and art. This was another thing. I geared away from art because I was told from the beginning I had no artistic talent. Well, then after I One of the great influences on my life is Al Thompson. And Al Thompson had the Gordon Hill Nursery and Flower Shop. And I went to work for Gordon Hill right out of the eighth grade, raking leaves and cleaning up and that type of thing. Eventually became their delivery boy when I got my driver's license. And then I did that through high school. And Al always had a job for me during the summertime or weekends and holidays. And we became friends. And after I graduated, I not only continued working with Al, but I also became social friends with him. And we would attend a lot of floral design things. Well, one day Al said to me, Al was a great artist, and we had a great art teacher, John Lamont, who was there. And Al said, why don't you...
Was he a football coach?
He coached football, and he coached track.
Uh-huh.
And he was teaching an adult watercolor class. And Al said, why don't you come out to John's class? And I said, I'm thinking back to my... I don't have any art ability. Well... I took a few art design classes as part of my industrial arts classes mm-hmm. in college, and one was color design. So I had some art theory, but none of it was of creative art kind of thing. And so Al said, why don't you come to class? So I went to class, and they stuck a board and gave me some paints, and I sketched out something, and I painted it, and I went, wow, I was pretty proud of that. When I look back on it now, it was pretty primitive. But anyway, I found some success in that, and so I went on and did pretty well in watercolor paint. I sold a lot.
Well, I got a couple of your paintings.
Yeah, I sold a lot, and I have a few. In fact, this year we took some of my watercolors and shrunk them down and made Christmas cards out of them.
Oh.
And I have a number of people saying, oh, I love it. I didn't know you did that. I'm going to frame it, you know. So, you know, so I have an art minor. So I have a industrial arts, art, physical education, and science minor. And then when I graduated with a degree in elementary education. But I started teaching math, and I wanted to teach math, you know, at the high school level, which I only did 1 year, by the way. And I was lucky enough to get involved with the National Science Foundation grants in 1960s when they started the space race and all that. They were trying to upgrade math and science teachers to compete worldwide. And so they came up with these National Science Foundation grants. And of course, I was a math teacher at the time, and I got 10 of them. And one of them was to East Tennessee State University, all expenses paid for myself and family. Another one was Baldwin Wallace in Ohio, which is a small school similar to UOP, and then a number of them locally. And so I got my secondary math credential by National Science Foundation grants.
Wow, that's neat.
Yeah, and then I went on, and then when I was hired at Independence High School, because there were only two of us, I didn't need to have an administrative credential. I could just operate on a regular teaching credential, but I knew as it grew that I'd have to get qualified. So I had an opportunity to go into an experimental program with Sac State, and it was called the off-campus program. And they offered an administrative master's degree at Bret Harte High School for the foothills. And there were 28 of us that enrolled in this. And it was a unique program because most of us got to be good friends, and we went through the whole master's degree program together.
Oh, that's cool.
And which doesn't happen. The professors were always amazed because they never taught with a group that all knew each other already because they were all usually scattered. So I got a master's degree in school administration and personnel management.
Oh, that's great.
So, yeah. So I had, you know, I had some unique opportunities along the way. And then when I was given a Sorenson tour, I'm talking about me again. I guess that's what we're here for,
that's
right?
That's what we're here for.
Okay. I was given a tour at Sorenson's Resort, and this fellow, I was still working at the time, getting ready to retire, and this fellow said, you ought to teach elder hostel classes, you know. And I said, well, you know, I've given that a thought. You know what elder hostel classes are. Anyway, given it, and he said, well, he put me in touch with a guy who was an alumni, worked for the Alumni Association of UOP at the Feather River Inn. And they held elder hostel classes up there. And they hired me. And so I went up there and I taught the Immigrant Trail, Westward Migration, Gold Rush history. Well, I knew, I never cared for history in school because I never had a good history teacher until I got to college. But I knew I'm going to teach 10 hours a week, 2 hours for 5 days. And I knew I did not want to stand in front of a podium and lecture for 2 hours, 5 days a week. That to me was deadly. And that turned me off. And so I came up with these ideas. And I had heard a guy give a talk one time, and he never talked from notes. And he was outstanding. His name was Fred Gallen. And he's one of the leading authorities on the fur trade. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you got some of this stuff.
I do.
And I went, how do I do that? You know, with all this stuff. Well, being a teacher as I was, the one thing I loved were timelines. So I made timeline charts of all the events, and I put them around the walls of the room. And they were big charts, so everybody can read it. And then I had, at certain dates, I had the paralleling events. You know, the Donner Party, or the Bidwell Bartleson Party, or whatever it was. And different. And so those were my notes. So I had the history, and all I needed were these trigger points. And, you know, why did... And, of course, I had lots of friends that helped me over the years, namely Keith Davis, as many of them. But why were people coming west? What was the Oregon Trail all about? And I think you're the one that keyed me on to the Great Panic of 1837. And I went, oh, that makes sense, you know, and all these kind of key things. And of course, then I went into intense study. And so then I had slideshows of the Immigrant Trail, and then Marianne and I wanted to teach some wagon train history. And we wanted to teach people what went into a wagon and what was it like for a family to prepare to get going. And but I didn't want to read, now here are all the supplies they took, and here are all the food, you know, here are the cooking equipment. So I started collecting and replicating all the items that would go into a wagon. And Marianne and I wrote a skit called Getting Ready to Go. And so I had this big display of all these cooking equipment. It was big. I had to haul it in my pickup and all that. And I made sacks with replicated 100 pounds of flour and all of this type of thing. And we wrote this skit called Getting Ready to Go. The setting was 1846 at Independence, Missouri. And it's a family of four. We called her Anna May, and I was Sylvester. And we used my grandmother's maiden name, Hale, as our last name. So we're Anna May and Sylvester Hale. And I love the word Sylvester because that was the name of partner in Painter Wagon.
Yeah.
And Anna May is a conversion of Marianne. And then we had Well, we had three children, and we used our children's names as the three children. And so we're getting ready to go, and I'm coming back into town, having just bought supplies, and we're talking about, well, we get everything, and then we better go over the cooking equipment. And so we run through this list and interrupt it every once in a while about, like, where's the butter churn? Well, I sold the butter churn. Why would you sell the butter churn? You know, we went back and forth like this on it. Noel, I found out you could just put it in a bucket and hang it from the wagon, and by noon it had churned itself. And, you know, and so there were little things in there that made it entertaining. And then, but our destination was Oregon Territory. And then Anime's asking me about the wagon. And she says, well, you know, if we pack carefully, we can take the 3,000 pounds, and Mama can go with us. Well, this was the mother-in-law. What this was a takeoff of Sarah Keyes, who was the mother-in-law of James Fraser Reed of the Donner Reed Party. And so what we were doing is that we were taking some pieces of history and molding them into our story. And
like a historical novel.
Yeah, similar to that. So anyway, she says, you know, that if we pack carefully, I don't see why we can't get 3,000 pounds on our farm wagon, you know, and take Mama. And I said, well, I sold the farm wagon. And, of course, Anna May goes in, well, you sold the farm wagon? Why would you do that? And I said, well, let me explain. I said, when I was in town today, I met the most delightful men, a Mr. Donner and a Mr. Reed. You know, the Donner Party, and they invited us to go to California. And they said that we could get to California by this shortcut written by a California attorney, Mr. Lansford W. Hastings, you know, far before we could, you know, 6 weeks before we could ever get to Oregon. And I thought that sounded like a good idea. Now, our farm wagon's too big, so we needed the little wagon, you know, da-da-da-da-da. And, of course, when the people hear that I've agreed to go with the Donner Party, the audience just gets brought right into
sure.
it. So it was a real hook
yeah.
into it. Well, bottom line is, she reads me some articles from the Oregon Spectator about Lansford Hastings and the ills of California, and talks me out of it. And of course, we end up in her mama dies, and we have to bury her on the prairie, and we end up in Oregon City, you know, in the Willamette Valley, and so it's very entertaining, and we did that,
and educational.
Yeah, that was the whole thing, is making an educational thing, and we got a lot of material in a 30-minute play.
Sure.
And then it generated a lot of questions. So we did those types of things in the Elder Hostel classes. Well, we went on and did that for 20 years. We actually did that. The last time I did it was was in Elko at the new California Trail Center over there. And we put that on there. And we decided that it was time to retire that. Because hauling, packing all this stuff, unpacking all this, was just getting to be a real pain. And so we retired the whole thing, and we donated nearly $3,000 worth of material to the Trail Center.
See, and that's great.
Yeah.
I mean, it's being used still.
So those are the kinds of things that I've had an opportunity to do. We performed that skit at our convention before 700 people, and it's been very, very well accepted.
Well, as I recall, you're for no better word, an expert about wagons, and if I'm not mistaken, didn't you help Sutter's Fort get a wagon there at one time?
Well, as a friend once said, I'm a student, and I really don't like the word expert.
All right, so you know more than the vast majority.
But I... as a result of this Elder Hostel class, we got hired by another group in Sacramento, the Traz Society.
The what society?
Traditional Jazz Society was holding Elder Hostel classes.
Uh-huh.
And mainly theirs was music, but they wanted a history class to go along with their music classes. So we brought our program down there. And one day there was a man that came to do a presentation, and he sat in on my presentation, and he said, you should be an interpreter at Sutter's Fort. And I said, well, you know, I thought about that. Well, I did nothing about it until I got a call from Sutter's Fort asking me if I would apply for their summer program called History Lock. And this was a paid position. And I thought, great, you know, that sounds like it'd be a lot of fun. So I took my resume and all stuff down there. Well, they had already had information on me from this other guy that was encouraging me to do it. So it was almost like a foregone conclusion that I was hired. And it was a discussion about what I was going to be able to contribute and all that. And I said, shouldn't you be asking me interview questions? Oh, yeah, maybe we ought to do it. You know. So anyway, I went ahead and was hired in, they called it History Live, and we dressed in period clothing. We didn't portray a character, but we just told about how the life was. And we had about 6 interpretive stations there. There was the immigrant station, which was where my expertise was. We had a trapper station, which I had a lot of background in. And then we had one called the sailor station, because there was some naval personnel that came and went from Sutter's Fort. The administrator, where Sutter's office was. The farmer, where the grist mill was, and blacksmith station, and there was also a vaquero station that operated occasionally, and so we would rotate through some of those.
No Indians?
No. No Native Americans. Even though it was brought in, there was no Native American station, and those were some of the things that I presented to them. But within the first year, you know, and I'm doing now, by this time now, I'm doing a lot of study on John Sutter and Sutter's Fort and this kind of stuff. And I'm reading John Sutter's day book, The New Helvetia Diary. And I'm reading about wagon after wagon after wagon coming and going and being used here and there. And so I said, you know, at one of our interpreters meetings, we were called Park Interpretive Specialists, a big term for a $10 an hour salary, you know. And but the qualifications were pretty high. In fact, we had higher qualifications for our positions than did the park ranger.
Huh.
And she said, I don't qualify to do what you're doing, but I get paid more than you. And so anyway, so we were at a meeting and I said, you know, I'm looking around and we have cannons, we have muskets, we have blacksmithing, we have, you know, a candle making, but we don't have a wagon. There's 138 references in New Helvetia Diary about wagons. In fact, one of them even a wagon used as an ambulance. I said, how come there's no wagon? And they looked at each other and it was like the light went on. Like, duh, well, yeah, well, let's go get a wagon. Well, you don't go get an 1846 wagon, because 1846 is what Sutter's Fort is interpreting. That's their focus year. And I said, I only know of 3 in existence, and they're all in museums, and they've been restored. And I said, so if we're going to get an 1840, we're going to have one built. Well, where can that happen? Well, through my connections with the trail associations, I had met wagon makers and I knew of wagon makers. And so I said, well, let me see if I can get some information. So I wrote to several of them and to see, you know, how much it would cost. And I got ranges from about $7,000 up to $20,000.
Wow, big difference.
Well, it was. And of course, a lot of it was quality of manufacture. And so they took this whole thing seriously. We need to get a wagon, but we have to form a committee. And I'm going, oh my God, state of California. I understand the need, because when you introduce a new concept into a historic setting like that, it's how does it fit into the setting? Who is it going to be? Who is the target audience? How is it going to be used? How is it going to be interpreted? You know, you develop a manual for that particular thing. It was candle making had to do this, and so you have this interpretive manual. How will it benefit kids? How will it benefit the general public? All of this has to be entered into it. And so we formed a committee, and actually it took us 7 years from the time I first presented the idea until we got the wagon. But the cost was going to be a big hindrance, and we were meeting monthly with our committee assembling the interpretive manual. And I'm supplying most of the material.
Right.
But there were others that did, they did their share. It was really, really good. And a lady came through the floor, and we had a little sign up that, you know, we were taking donations because we're going to have a wagon built and this type of thing. A lady came through and says, I think I have a connection to get a grant. So, we got kind of excited about that, and one person took the lead on that. And after a few years, we got a $20,000 grant to have a wagon made. And we selected Hanson Wheel and Wagon Works in Mitchell, South Dakota. And of course, by this time, I had contacted all of our experts, our meaning OCTA people, who I'd worked with and gotten lots of information on the specifics of a wagon, and contacted Hanson and told him what we were wanting to do, and he was really excited. And Marianne and I went out in August to our Trails Convention, which was held in Kansas that year, and we just continued on and went into Mitchell, South Dakota, where Hanson was, and I spent a whole day with him. And he has a magnificent shop, and he does a lot of restorations. But he builds things for Disneyland and you know, restores stagecoaches and all that. And he was really excited because he had never built an 1846 replicated wagon from the ground up.
Wow!
And I had taken a few wagon parts that I had, And he and I was saying, well, we need this kind of thing, and we need this kind of stuff, and it needs to fit this, and what makes it 46 versus 1860 wagon and that type of thing. And he was so careful throughout the manufacturing phase that he would call me and say, or email me and say, you know, we're getting ready to lay in the floorboards. Are we using tongue and groove, or are we using butt joints? And I'd say, Doug, my guess is butt joints, but let me check with my people. So I get a hold of two or three people, and we all agree, yeah, butt joints. And he says, well, that's what I thought, but I didn't want to move ahead. And then he'd say, you know, we're getting ready to set the bows, and what is the degree of tilt for the front and back bow? Let me get back to you, Doug. So I get, you know, we would decide it was about a 3 degree tilt, and that's for the drip line, mm-hmm. so that water doesn't drip into the wagon, but it drips on over the edge. And so we ended up getting the wagon. Well, it was June of, I want to say 96 or something like that. I have a hard time remembering exactly when that was. Well, in fact, I got a manual here somewhere. I can come up with the dates if you really need them.
No, that's okay.
But anyway, Marianne got a call. I was gone somewhere. And, well, first of all, he said, okay, we're getting ready to ship the wagon. He called me. And I said, that's great. I hung up, and then I called him back, and I said, where are you shipping this wagon? he was going to ship it to my home address.
Oh, that's good.
And I went, oh, no, wrong. It's got to go to Sutter's Fort. So I gave him the address there. So, okay. So anyway, they called from Sutter's Fort and to tell me the wagon has arrived. And Marianne was talking to him, and they said, the wagon's here. We don't know how to unload it. Because it's in a big, high truck, common carrier.
Yeah.
And there's no loading dock. And they didn't have any ramps.
Oh, no.
And so Marianne said, why don't you get a hold of a tow truck company that has a flatbed tow truck on it? Great idea. So they did. They called a tow truck company, and the guy was so excited about doing this, he brought his family.
Oh, really?
Backed up the tow truck to the van. It matched perfectly. The carrier, the big truck, rolled the wagon onto the tow truck bed. The truck pulled away. They padded and attached the winch, tilted the bed, and lowered the wagon right onto the ground.
Oh, wow.
And, of course, they photographed the whole thing, so they documented all that. So the wagon had landed. Well, the minute I got a chance, I ran down there to see the wagon, and, God, it was beautiful.
Yeah.
And after 7 years of struggle, and, of course, it became known as Frank's wagon, In fact, there it is, right over there, I then proceeded to do an in-service training to the docents down there on wagon construction and wagon preservation and how you pulled it and what kind of draft animals, and I still do a little bit of that, but the fellow over and that holding the wheel there on the right, his name is Howdy Hoover. His wife was on the original committee. Well, he was too. And anyway, he's since taken over the maintenance of the wagon, and he's doing a fabulous job. And he's still a docent down at Sutter's Fort. So he's taking care of the wagon. So again, I had an opportunity to be at the right place at the right time. And that first summer, we had three men that came into the Sutter's Fort, and they spotted the wagon, and they were just thrilled with it and asked if they could really get in it and under it and all. Yeah. And they spent a long time scrutinizing this and then came back and said, we've looked at wagons all across the country, and you guys did it right.
Oh, wow.
We found out they were Amish.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. And,
they know they're craft.
Yeah. So they knew that we had replicated the wagon correctly. And it is a centerpiece of the fort now. The students that come there, they're allowed to get in it and play with it. And we have this big debate. Should we get a wagon that is new and fresh, or should we get a wagon that looks like it's been came across the prairie, a little beat up? And we decided that would look artificial. If we tried to, so we decided, no, let's buy a new one. We'll make it look, like everything was hand forged on it, all the metal parts and all that, and let us just age gracefully, and it'll wear with kids getting in and out, and it is, it's aging gracefully, but I think it was the correct decision. So,
I think most people were probably surprised when they first look at it. They probably thought the wagons were going to be bigger.
Yeah. And they're about, the box is about 3.5 feet wide and about 10 feet long,
yeah.
Which is a surprise. And I say it's about the size of a minivan, mm-hmm. And you're going to put on 5 months of supplies and haul that across the country. So those are some of the unique experiences I've had an opportunity to do. And it all started on our patio in Pine Grove when Glenn said, why don't you sign up as a volunteer? And I said, yeah, that'll be fun for two or three summers, And So here it is after all these years. In fact, there's a poster right there of Hanson's Wheel and Wagon Shop.
Well, Frank, it's almost 55 minutes again, so I'm going to put a little stop here.
Okay, and I'm going to...
Frank, we're starting our third session here, and I'd like to get a little bit to some of the activities that you've been involved in the county. I know you've been you've held a couple different offices and been involved in a couple different groups. I'd like for you to discuss that with me, or tell me the different organizations that you've been involved with.
Oh gosh. Well, I guess, I've been a member of the Italian Benevolent Society. I've been a member of the Jackson Lions Club, the member of the Emerald County Historical Society, which I still am a member of that. In fact, I was president of that for 3 or 4 years. And I still involved with them somewhat. I think I'm on the advisory committee, but they never meet or anything. I go to the meetings occasionally. Most recently, I guess, has been the project that Keith Sweet has headed up on the preservation and the restoration of Wheel Number 4, mm-hmm. and the renovation of the Tailing Wheels Park. And I was part of that committee from the very beginning, and also up at the Rotary Club Overlook, where we put in, 6 or 7 brand new interpretive signs up there. All that was done with the grants that Keith Sweet was able to obtain from the Transportation Enhancement Act, or commonly called the T-Money. And I was fortunate to be asked, along with Larry Sonato and Ed Arata and Grant Huggett and a number of other people, to serve on that committee, and Marianne too. And so Larry and I did most of the historic research for the text that went into those plates up there. And then worked as an advisor on the mechanics of the tailing wheels and the paintings that Rand Huggett had done. Because he was very interested in getting them historically correct. And between Ed and I think both of us had enough knowledge, we were able to put together most of it. One of the things that Marianne and I did was when the Kennedy Mine property was finally acquired by the Kennedy Mine Foundation from Sybil Arata, it was a nonprofit corporation was formed, and Marianne was hired as the first manager, and I was hired, or she volunteered because there was no pay involved. But then I came along and I did most of the historic research for them and set up the first guided tour. And then we, Marianne organized the volunteers and the cleanup, and so we went up there when the place was in pretty shabby condition. And it's been a joy to watch it grow. We put in 2 intense years, which was our commitment, she and I made to each other. Let's give this 2 years and see what we can do. And then we did that. We set up the tour guide book and trained the tour guides and got the whole thing going. And then she and I stepped away from it. And it's still going on today. And so it's been fun to watch it grow and develop way beyond that. But the reason we step back is because of all of my other trail work and my research and all the other things that we just wanted to do that for the community. And you know, the Kennedy Mines were areas I played there as a kid. And all four tailing wheels were standing, and I could walk the flume from tailing wheel number four all the way up to the stamp mill. It was all intact. It went right over Jackson Gate Road. And, you know, so I had that kind of memory. Little did I know how important those were from a historic standpoint. My dad loved the wheels, and he was trying to preserve the wheels probably for the last 50 years. And he was a good friend of Evelyn Gabarini, whose husband was an engineer and had worked on the wheels. And so I helped him out part of that time, too.
I know the book 47 Down talks a lot about, is it V.S. Gabarini you're talking about?
Yeah, yeah.
Talks a lot about him.
That would have been her father-in-law.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that would have been her father-in-law. he was the one that was the engineer that designed the head frame and all that for the Kennedy Mine. And then he was, you know, helped with the rescue and that type of thing.
Yeah. So, Frank, what was it like growing up in Wild Jackson at the time? I remember when I was telling my principal at the time, when I was teaching at Rio Linda, that I was coming up to Jackson for an interview. He goes, "Oh my God, what a great place that Jackson is." He says, "I remember when," and it goes into great detail of the fun he had. Was it really that wild at the time for it?
Well, you know, it's all I knew as a kid. It's mm-hmm. what we grew up with. My dad was a barber, so he was right down in the middle of Jackson with all the action going, and of course he knew barbershops are the rumor mills, and so
yeah.
You know, all the politicians showed up there, and you know, all the local color was there, and my dad knew everybody and they knew him, and my dad was great in belonging to the organizations, and so my parents were very, very involved in the community. I can remember as a kid maybe being 10, 11 years old, walking down, and why I was doing this, I don't remember, but walking down Main Street of Jackson at 10 o'clock on a Saturday night and listening to the music and the noise and being able to see people in the bar and the casinos and the restaurants. And it was just a busy, happy, safe place. You know, and of course, this went on until the mid-1950s. You know, when I think it was 1955 or 56, when Edward G. Brown, who was Attorney General at the time, as I recall, came in and shut everything down. And of course, that created a whole lot of hullabaloo, and you know, and there were four operating bordellos, you know, within walking distance of Main Street. And then all the gambling casinos, as I said before, there were 19, as I recall, 19 bars and casinos between the Bank of America and the old kitchen store, and you know, four barbershops, four jewelry stores. You know, the place was just bustling.
Yeah.
Safeway was right on Main Street.
Now, where was Safeway located at then?
Safeway was located on the east side of Main Street, about four doors up from the National Hotel.
Okay.
Right there on the corner where, what do they call it, the 49er Club. When I was a kid, it was called the R&R Club, and then it became the Wells Fargo. And so Safeway was right up there. After Safeway left, there was a Boss's plumbing shop went in there, and then eventually Sammy's restaurant, Chinese restaurant, went in there. Safeway moved around the corner on Water Street, and were there, gosh, for a long time, and then they moved up to True Value, where True Value is by the library.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually over back off of Highway 49, where the grocery outlet is now.
Right.
And then just in the last 10 years or so, they moved up to Martell. There were, I can remember on Main Street, there were two grocery stores. One was called Raggio's, and the other one was called Casanelli's, and both of those delivered. So the little elderly ladies, they could call up and order their groceries, and they would be delivered to their house. So, you know, it was, you know, of course, milk was delivered. I can remember old man Privitali with his Model A Ford pickup and his cow behind going down the street to one pasture or another, and then another farmer bringing his produce into town, pulled by a horse, you know, and they would go to the neighborhood. My mother would go out on the street and buy her groceries from Dan the vegetable man or something like that, you know. But it was, you know, we, most of us had bicycles and we rode all over town. We could go anywhere. It was perfectly safe. It was hard to get into much trouble as a kid because everybody knew everybody, and it was, everybody took care of each other. And if I was doing something I shouldn't have been doing, my folks knew about it before I got home, you know, and, I didn't like that as a kid, but, you know, as a parent, I think that's a pretty cool way to operate, you know. So we took care of each other, you know, and the other nice thing is that there were lots of kids that I started first grade with and went all the way and graduated from high school with.
That is nice.
Yeah, you know, which is just, it's just rare anymore.
Mm-hmm.
For that to happen, even as small a community as Emeritus County is now, that still doesn't happen like that anymore. You know, there's too much people coming and going. So, you know, it was a fun place. We were the forerunners to Little League. I belonged to two teams. One was called the Junior Druids, sponsored by the local Druids organization, and the other one was the Jackson Lions, and we played on the high school field or at the elementary school fields down in Ione, which was a slanted field, so if the ball was hit over your head, you just turned around and waited for it to roll back.
Yeah, that's funny.
But we played baseball rules, but we used a softball. Because I guess they figured it was too dangerous for us to use a hard ball. And our uniforms were a T-shirt and a ball cap, and that was it. And we had a lot of fun, and it was the forerunner to Little League.
Now, I understand there was a small golf course there.
Yeah, there was a small golf course where the new hospital is now, and about 1948, 50, somewhere in there, my parents bought a house right on top of the hill on Golf Course Road, and there was a 6-hole sand green golf course. Greens were made out of sand and sawdust and oil, and then it was naturally irrigated. So it was playable really nice in the winter time when there was rain and you could have grass, and they mowed it. And then in the summertime, it all dried up. And so the golfers usually went somewhere else where they could get green grass. But I grew up there, and on the weekends, I'd go out and caddy for the locals, the men, and they'd give me 50 cents or something, and they taught me how to play golf.
Yeah.
And that's where I learned how to play golf, on that little 6-hole sand green golf course. In fact, I'd go out and help them maintain it, and I'd rake the greens for them or help them mow the lawns, and they made me an honorary member of the Jackson Golf Club. So,
now, was there a football field out there close by that, too?
You know, this is I've been told about it, but I don't remember it in my recollection. It was called Zyla Field.
Yeah, that's what I was getting at.
And it was on the old Zyla Mine property. Mm-hmm. And right where the Clinton Road apartment complex is, right on that flat. And the football team would dress up at the high school in their football uniforms, and then they would run all the way up to Zyla Field. That was part of their training, you know, their conditioning, and then they'd practice, and then they'd run back up to the high school and to take their showers and change clothes and go home. I don't recall that, but that's what I've been told. And I recall the whole football scene when it was at the high school. And my memory there goes back to, I think the high school football field was there from the 40s on, because I can remember...
Now you're talking about Butte Bowl.
Yeah, the Butte Bowl, where the junior high, presently, it was that was the old high school. And I think they were starting to play there, because I can remember as a little kid being up there when, I want to say people like Maurice Plass and Frank Boozy, and those were playing ball. Brooks Golden was the coach, mm-hmm. and he called them all knuckleheads, you know. And then, of course, when I got old enough, and when I was a freshman in high school, you know, I weighed probably all of about 115 pounds, 20 pounds maybe, and I had a helmet too big for me. But the funniest thing is in our equipment storage, we still had some leather helmets.
Wow.
You know, the old Notre Dame-style leather helmets they played in the 30s. And they were still in that equipment locker. And, of course, we'd put them on and joke about them. But we had the hard shell helmets by then. When I was a sophomore playing football, that's when the face mask first came in. Hmm. And my first face mask was about an inch and a half clear plastic bar that ran from ear to ear. And there
was one bar?
One bar, yeah, with clear plastic and about an inch and a half wide and about, maybe a half inch thick. It was pretty tough stuff. But we had no face mask regulation. And that was a sophomore year, and I'm probably up to about 125 running back. And I go running around end, and this big tackle would reach up and grab my mask and just put me right on the ground, you know, for the tackle, and there was no rule against it. It could have been probably pretty dangerous.
Yeah.
But then I think the rule probably came in about my junior year where face masks were illegal. I don't remember. But I remember it was a handle that was, you couldn't do anything about it once they grabbed it. And as you see now in pros, boy, you touch that face mask and there's a penalty. So yeah, I was, in those days, you could be a senior and play junior varsity football. In fact, Ione High School was so small, they only played junior varsity football. They didn't have a varsity team. And so all of their seniors were playing junior varsity. And my junior year, I was first string fullback for the junior varsity and first string middle linebacker for the junior varsity and second string fullback on the varsity and second string linebacker for the varsity. Well, at the middle of the fourth quarter of the JV game, I'd go down and change uniforms and go back up with the varsity. And I played behind George Perovich, who was a sophomore, but we called him Tank, and he was a big, hefty, talented running back and went on to play a little bit of pro ball. But he was a hothead. And so he'd lose his temper and get kicked out of the game. So there were some games I played eight quarters of football in one night, both JV and varsity. And I loved it. And, you know, I look now and we got to give them a rest. You know, they're going one way and they're tired, you know. And I'm thinking, I played eight quarters.
Yeah, those days are gone.
Those days are all gone. Yeah, my senior year, though, I just played varsity. And we went We only lost one game my senior year, and that was to Calaveras.
Now, were the leagues same back then as they are now?
We didn't have Linden. We had I think it was the same except for Linden.
Was Sonora in the league or not?
No, Sonora had left the league probably in the early 40s.
Mm-hmm. Was Somerville in the league?
Somerville was in. Ione was in. Oh, that would have been the other team. Would have been Ione. Yeah, yeah, that was the other team. And our rival was Sutter Creek Amador, and we always called them Sewer Creek. And it was right in the late 40s when they changed from Sutter Creek High School to Amador High School. But we always called them Sewer Creek, you know, and we were great rivals. But we were also great friends. And all the kids, we knew each other from both schools, and we would have shared dances together. And the Sutter Creek guys would date the Jackson girls, and I dated some of the Sutter Creek girls. And, you know, we just had great time. But on the football field or the basketball court, you know, we were enemies.
Right.
So that was, but one of the things that I always, you know, tout with the Amador guys or the Sutter Creek guys, the alumni, is that in the 4 years of high school, my high school years, Amador didn't score a point against us.
Not one point.
And the highest game was 62-0. And the lowest score was 27-0, and I think that was my senior year.
Wow.
When we beat them 27-0.
A lot of things run in cycles.
Yeah. And we just dominated, you know. But Calaveras was the dominant team during those days. And like I say, my senior year, we only lost one game, and that was to Calaveras. Otherwise, we would have been a league champ. Mm-hmm. And in those days, when you were the league champ, that was it. That was
right.
The end of football season.
Right.
You know, now they go on and on and on. You know, it seems like it never ends.
Yeah, you're right about that.
But it's
now, celebrations like Labor Day, Memorial Day, 4th of July, were those big events around here?
Memorial Day always was, because we had a lot of young men that were killed in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
So Memorial Day, Labor Day, our big event would have been Italian picnic.
Mm-hmm.
That was always a big one, you know, and everybody went out for the Italian picnic, the big parade in Sutter Creek. Labor Day, I don't recall that being much, but what we did celebrate was Veterans Day. And that's when we would play our rivalry football game against Amador. And
always on that day.
Always on the 11th, no matter what day, except on if it fell on a Sunday. We didn't
sure.
play on a Sunday, but that was always a big deal. It was just the varsity game, and there would be a parade and rally in the morning, and then there would be a breakfast for the seniors down at the Wells Fargo, and of course there was always pep talks and alumni coming back and giving the rah-rah stuff. So it was a big deal. It was a big tradition. And I don't know what it went on at Amador. I'm sure they did a similar kind of thing. And then at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, we would play our football game. And at that time, because it was Veterans Day, the American Legion would turn out, and they would have the color guard there. And they would have the flags, the American flag and the rear flag, California flag there on the side of the field, and at halftime there was a ceremony and they moved them from one side of the field to the other side of the field. I never saw only a couple of those or one of those, you know, because I was always in the locker room. I saw them before I got into high school, but that was the tradition, and it was always neat. And so it kind of lost some of its flavor when they changed it to a traditional Friday night. But there now is a traditional
right,
Friday night
right.
game, you know. So
well, we still have the downtown rally, but I'm sure it's not what it used
well,
to be.
Well, it's not on the same day, and, you know, it's like I think it's on Wednesday before the big game. And, you know, I mean, those are all new traditions that You know, like my grandkids, that's all they know. But you know, those were different times. And
now you mentioned earlier that your parents were very active in the community. What were some of the things they did that you can recall? Clubs, organizations, church functions.
Oh gosh.
Everything, huh?
Yeah, I can remember my mother was president of the Native Daughters of the Golden West. And she was always so proud of that because that was Ursula Parlor number one, where the Native Daughters were founded in Jackson.
Right.
Back in the 1880s sometime. And then my dad was, of course, he couldn't be in the Native Sons because he was born in New Orleans. But he was a member of the Eagles and the Druids and the Lions Club. And he was a big backer of the Quarterback Club.
Yeah, I know he was president for a while.
Probably.
Well, I've seen the list of them.
Oh, okay.
So he was, Frank. Yeah.
very community-minded, very, at one time there was a group that wanted him to run and become a supervisor, county supervisor. And my dad was really a neat guy, but he also had a little bit of insecurity about him because he never graduated from high school. And I think in his own mind, he didn't think he was worthy to be a supervisor or something like that. And, of course, my mother hated politics, and so she didn't want any part of it, so she wasn't very supportive of him getting into politics. And my dad was well-liked, everybody liked him. He was part of the good old boy system with John Begovich and, you know, Breivich and, Vukovich and all.
So did the Vitches really run the county?
Well, no. John John Begovich was a really important figure, a war hero.
Sure.
The Begoviches grew up in Plymouth. I think there were three boys, at least two that I remember. And John, became a war hero, and then he came back and he was a justice court judge. In those days, all you had to do was be willing and to be a justice court judge. And he was sitting on the bench when Brown raided the town and shut everything down. And then the girls who were all arrested had to appear before the judge. Well, that was Begovich. And the newspaper reports cited that this one prostitute came in into John's court, and she had her head down, and then she looked up and saw Begovich, and she goes, "Oh, hi, Johnny." And he responded, "Well, hi, Babs. $50, and you're out of here." That whole thing was so scandalous. Because everybody went into denial on even knowing about the prostitution. The prostitution was a bigger issue, really, than the gambling, for whatever reason. And the gambling just kind of shut down and went away. But the prostitution, everybody got involved with that. There was a grand jury investigation, and the mayor and everybody were called up to testify, and the police chief. And of course, the mayor at that time was our local plumber who worked for Spinetti Brothers. And when he testified, and this is in the newspaper, I'm not
right.
giving you rumors.
We're saying it's in the newspaper.
You know, that when he would testify about, well, you know, you're the mayor of town and you're allowing this prostitution to go on. And he says, well, I was a plumber. I went down there. I thought it was a woman's boarding house. You know, those were the kinds of things
sure.
that showed up in the testimony. The chief of police, when he testified, he didn't know anything was going on because he had his parking meters to take care of. You know, I mean, the whole thing was so ludicrous, and of course, all the cops were on the take, to ignore it. But it was a way of life.
And did not those houses, so to speak, then they really weren't they supportive of the whole community as far as giving of donations and things of this. And weren't they part of the society?
They
ran a business and everybody respected
them. Now, most of the girls were not residents of Amador County. Most of the girls came up out of the valley.
Mm-hmm.
The madams probably lived locally. But most of the girls, they came up, they were business girls. They came up and did their business and then went back to the valley. And so there probably were just maybe a handful. I think at that time, if I recall the numbers, there were like 75 girls working between the four houses. And of course, the one house that I always like to talk about was the one where Mel and Faye's Drive-In is.
Presently,
yes. Mm-hmm. And that originally was called the Aces Room or the Drive-In Bordello, because that was on the back alley of Jackson at the time. The bridge wasn't in there, and so this alley ran around. Chinatown, what they call Chinatown, was back there as well. And so you drove down Owl Alley behind all of the residences to the end of the road, and there's where the Aces Room was, or the Drive-In Bordello. And of course, then in 49 or whenever, they put the bypass through, which is now Highway 49, put the bridge in, and so the bordello continued to operate right there on the highway. It never shut down, and so there it was, for everybody to see. So when everything was raided and everything shut down, I was working in the gas station, which was right next door. That's a realtor office now. It was a Union 76 gas station. I was a junior, going into my junior year in high school. And a couple would pull in, and the wife would go to the restroom, and the husband always went, "What are these houses, that I've been hearing about?" And I said, "Well, there's one of them right there." "Oh, not right on the highway." I mean, they were just, totally appalled that how could they have it right there on the highway in front of everybody? And so that was pretty funny. And then that, of course, that then became known as the Cat House Antiques.
Right.
And then eventually, they tore that down and Mel's Drive-In, built their new hamburger stand there. One of the other ones was called the Brookside Room, and it was located down by the creek, just next to the National Hotel, to the right side. And there's a road called the Vogan Alley, that goes down there and then curves around paralleling the creek, and it was down there called the Brookside Room. And then there were two of them that were where the Bank of America parking lot is now. There was a Ford garage on the corner, and then some buildings, and then a bar called the Bridge Cabin. This spanned over the river, and the access to those two bordellos, Dixie's and Jeannie's, was through the Bridge Cabin, or there was a footbridge off of Water Street that went over, and that's the only way you could get to those two. And so those actually, I don't remember what happened to the Brookside, but the Dixie's and Jeannie's, when things started changing and they tore down the buildings in front, those became private residences. And they were there, up until the late 60s, even later than that. And then when Bank of America came in, those were torn down and they made a parking lot out of it. So, as a kid, we knew they were there.
Sure.
I only know of, my firsthand information, maybe three high school boys that ever went down to the houses. Or if they did, they weren't telling. But,
right.
Nobody in my class that I knew of ever went down there. They were there, and we knew they were there, but, I saw some of the girls. CB's drugstore was right across the street from the Aces Room, and CB's in the back is where the Sacramento Bee and the Stockton Record would be delivered, and so the paper boys would go down there and count our papers and roll our papers for our delivery route. And the girls would walk across the street through the back door to get their drugs and supplies from CB's pharmacy there. And so we knew who they were. They were, as I recall, they were all attractive-looking gals, you know. But we'd all titter, there's one of the prostitutes right there, you know. Oh, yeah, you know, big time for us. But that's the only association I ever knew. I don't think they frequented Main Street or anything like that. Mm-hmm. So it was pretty discreet. They were there. We knew about it. Nobody seemed to give much credence to it. It was part of the economy. Just we knew the owners.
The newspapers made a big deal of it.
Well, of course, yeah. You know, and it was a big deal, you know. And, you know, it's where else?
Right.
But, you know, and of course, you know, it was all, when you look at it from a legal standpoint, it was all corrupt. You know, it was illegal to operate, but it was ignored, and it was mining times, and, you know, and it went on into the 50s.
And then the city gambling places closed down, and then they had to, were they also other businesses with the gambling, or was some of it just strictly gambling? And then
almost all of them, most of them were associated with a restaurant.
Okay.
But not all of them.
Or a bar?
They all had a bar, as I recall. Some of them had pool rooms, mm-hmm. You know, like the Rex, the Pioneer Rex, had a major restaurant in town. And then they had the bar, and then behind the bar was gambling. The Wells Fargo Club was primarily, the restaurants came and went in my memory, but it was primarily the bar and the casino. The Louvre, as they referred to it, which is spelled the same as the Louvre Art Gallery in Paris, was another major restaurant where all the kids went.
Now, where was that located?
That was located, it would approximately be underneath where the Wells Fargo Bank is today.
Okay.
In that general area.
Sure.
You went downstairs and walked down a hallway, and on your left there were swinging doors, and that's where the casino was. And then the lunch counter and the restaurant were in the back. And that was a very good restaurant. I'm trying to think. To the left side of the National Hotel downstairs was the Klondike Club, and it was more of a minor. It was a bar with probably slot machines and stuff. Underneath the National Hotel, where the steak restaurant is now, that was a gambling hall and a restaurant also, mm-hmm. downstairs there. I don't remember a bar being around there, but I'm sure there was.
Can you address the what I've heard off and on through the years is that there is a complex of tunnels that intersected all that. Are you aware of any of that? Or is it just a tunnel from one place to another and close by, or do they really have tunnels going all over underneath them?
You know, to my knowledge, that's not true. I know nothing about tunnels. I do know that everything, most of the establishments, particularly on the west side of Main Street, would that be the west or the south or whatever, all of those had basements, where Swenson's Shoe Store is now, mm-hmm. was originally the Spinetti Brothers Hardware Store. Well, downstairs, they had almost a full basement downstairs, and that's where all their paint supplies were and storage. The Native Daughters actually met, I think, and organized in a basement up by the Jackson Cleaners underneath down in there.
Okay. I've been there.
Yeah, and so, and a lot of those had the double iron doors that opened, and they were right on Main Street or just inside their store doors. You know, and then the bank club was downstairs underneath the Krabanoff Hall. It was a side entrance where the walkway went across, and then the bridge went across the creek over the Aces rooms in Chinatown.
Mm-hmm.
So at least that whole side of town had cellars to it. And probably the reason for that is the Jackson Creek ran right behind there.
Right.
And so they didn't want to build the town right on the creek, so they kind of built it up above the creek on the bank. But here was natural storage.
Mm-hmm.
On the other side of town, I don't recall any cellars there. But this tunnel thing, I've heard that rumor before. If it existed, I don't know where it existed. Now, I heard Sutter Creek had something like that. I don't know.
As a kid, you would have known.
you would have thought so, yeah.
So you're on a date, and you want to take your date to get a soda or something. Where would you go?
Oh, gosh. We had a place called the Butte Bowl that we went to quite a bit. That was down at where JB's
Trophy.
That was called the Butte Bowl.
Upstairs and downstairs, then, right?
No, it's just downstairs.
Okay.
And it was a typical 1940s, 50 jukeboxes, soda fountains that had like a curved lunch counter, and then booths with a little machine, the jukebox machine hanging on the wall. You could still find some of those around today that have harked back to that. But it was a where the kids hung out. That was a favorite hangout. The Loop was another place we went to. There was another place about where Marigas is, and that was called, that was a drive-in.
Oh, really?
And it was probably the first real hamburger stop in Amador County, Askey's Drive-In. And it had like 9 booths on it. They also had the first television that I know of in Amador County. And my friends were good friends of Bill. His name was Ascagorda. And Bill and his wife opened this hamburger place. And they had car hops. They weren't on roller skates, but they had car hops. And so we would go out there and order milkshakes. And, of course, we could sit in the car and make out and, you know, and have our hamburger and have a root beer or something. But I can remember going down and watching the Friday night fights. My dad was big into boxing, and they made good hamburgers.
Now, where was the fights at?
They were on television.
Oh, okay. On television.
Yeah, you know, Jersey Joe Walcock, Joe Louis, those guys, you know. And, of course, they were big, you know, and we'd watch the hit parade, you know, the
right.
Big tunes of the day. Where else did we go? There was two great soda fountains in Jackson. One called Sophie's, which was right across the street from the Amador Theater, the movie house, which is where the parking lot is now, between the cleaners and it used to be the bank. Is there a bank there now? I don't know, Main Street. But anyway, that was a really nice theater. Saturday night, Saturday afternoon.
Yeah, I know where you're at.
Placer Savings, I think, was there. I don't know what's there right now. They changed it, though. But anyway, that's where the theater was. And they had a balcony. And, of course, the high school kids, you had to be a certain age to go in the balcony. And that's where the high school kids would go out and neck up there, you know, in the balcony. And all the rest of the little kids were down on the floor. But they had... matinees and, you know, Saturday afternoon matinees with the Lone Ranger and all that kind of stuff. But they ran full-line movies, so that was good. I think as a kid, it cost me 25 cents to go to the movies. And then right across the street was Sophie's. And that was a typical old soda fountain, and she made root beer floats and milkshakes and that kind of stuff. And the other one was up the wrecks. And
The wrecks, that's where the Celtic house is now? Celtic Knot?
The wrecks is where Rosebuds is.
Okay.
And then right next to that was, I'm trying to think of the name of it, but it was a drugstore soda fountain.
Mm.
God, the name slips my memory right now. What's the name of that? Oh, it'll come to me.
That's okay. You've remembered a lot so far.
Oh, I've got it right there in my book. I could look it up. So that was another popular place. And then there were a couple of pool halls in town that the high school kids would go down and we'd play pool and, you know, that type of thing. So
did the chief of police live where Bella Rosa restaurant is?
Yes.
I've heard that.
Yes, Guy Toffanelli, that was his home. And when I was in high school, he had a hopped up, no, it wasn't hopped up, I'm being facetious. He drove a 55 Chevy that could top out at about 55, you know, and so he wasn't going to go on any chase. But, you know, in those days, you didn't have to chase anybody. You just wait for them because they're going to come back.
There's only one or two minutes.
You know, but, you know, one of the things that we did as a kid, you know, our mischievous thing was, where Gordon Hill Flower Shop is now and the bike shop, well, there was a bank there. And, of course, right over the bank were Dixie and Jeannie's Bordellos. And they had corrugated iron roofs. So as kids, three or four of us get together on a Saturday night, and we'd go down there and we'd get as big a rocks as we could throw. And we would throw them over on top of that corrugated iron roof. You know, well, it made just a hell of a racket when it hit, bam, bam, bam. And then we ran across the street and hid under the trees up there. And then pretty soon, here came Guy Toffanelli in his 55 Chevy patrolling by, you know, and he'd go by.
He's going to come by.
You know, and then we wait 20 minutes or so and go down, throw some more rocks down there on top of the roof, and pretty soon here he came. So, you know, when he says, and this is what's so funny about him denying he had to take care of his meters, if he didn't know they were there, where was he getting these calls, you know, to come, somebody's throwing rocks on our roofs, you know. So that was our entertainment.
Sure.
I don't know what went on inside those rooms when those rocks hit, but it had to create quite an excitement.
So, Frank, is there anything that you would like to talk about or mention that I haven't asked about?
Oh, gosh. I don't know if I've answered all your questions. I seem to get sidetracked. I would, you know, overall, Jackson was a great place to grow up. Everybody knew everybody. The downside of it is everybody also knew everybody's personal business.
Sure.
And of course, it was the gossip, you know. Well, I'll tell you two stories. One thing is we had a party line. And of course, that was where gossip happened because
sure.
You could listen in. You know, and my mother was, and you'd have to pick the receiver up and listen to see if anybody was on it, you know, and then, you know, usually they would take, put it down, we're on the line, you know, but I can remember the phone number, and it was 139J, you know, why I remember that phone number, I don't know. But the other thing, talking about the rumor mill, there was a spinster lady that lived down in one of those stucco houses down on North Main by Bella Rose, as you were talking about, mm-hmm. And her name was Hilda Poggi, and she was just a nice old lady and a spinster, never was married. Well, I told you that one of the grocery stores and variety stores in Jackson was called Casanelli's. And it was located about where Stan's trading store is. Actually, that was the bank club was under Casanelli's, now that I recall. And the Webb building was a little bit farther up. The Webb building was the General Motors dealership. Prior to that, it was a livery stable. So it went from a livery stable to an automobile dealership.
Kept the wheels.
Yeah. So anyway, the Casinellis, you know, ran the grocery delivery. They also handled furniture and hardware and all that kind of stuff. And Pete Casinelli, they're all dead now, was quite a character. And he came home for lunch one day or after work or something like this. And his wife wanted to know, well, what's the latest? What's going on? Well, he couldn't think of anything. So he said, oh, I don't know. I heard that Hildy Poggi's pregnant. Well, here's this spinster, you know. And Hildy Poggi's pregnant. And so she gets on the phone, and of course she's starting to call him, and he hears her, and he goes, no, I'm just kidding, you know. So I don't know how far that rumor traveled, but you know the story. Oh, of course, so you know, she was so mad at him, but it was easy to start a rumor if you really wanted to be a prankster, you could start a rumor like that, and also. But that's one story I really remember. Oh, Pete almost got himself into trouble. And of course, you know, going along with this Bordello thing, the other big event, you know, happened was when the quote Filthy Five put the heart-shaped plaque in to commemorate prostitution. And that goes back to about 1966, somewhere in that period, when five guys in town decided that Jackson needed to preserve their heritage of prostitution. And so they went around, and these were all prominent citizens and who did some historically good things, and so they were going around telling they're going to have this plaque commemorating the early days of Jackson and raise money. And so on, I think it was Valentine's Day of about 1966, they embedded a heart-shaped plaque in the cement, which would in front of now, which is the Bank of America, I guess it was then too, I'm not sure, to commemorate prostitution. And it was not a really historically well-done thing, but it said something like, you know, to preserve the memory of if you can stop it, I will get the actual text for you. I think I have that. Here, you can have that.
Oh, you're funny. We're going.
Okay. It was a heart-shaped plaque. Up in the upper left-hand part was a red light. On the right-hand side was a dollar symbol. And it said Botelius Bordellos. Botelius was the original name of Jackson, meaning bottles, before it became Jackson. And the text reads, world's oldest profession flourished 50 yards east of this plaque for many years until the most perfect example of free enterprise was padlocked by unsympathetic politicians. Okay, well, that's not exactly the way you write up a historic plaque, you know. Obviously, it was biased, and it's dated 1968. And they had a big celebration there. And the mayor was there speaking about it, and the mayor was Pete Casinelli at the time. And they had, I think they might have had TV coverage and all of this kind of stuff, and a program put out, and all the contributors, of which one was Valva's Barbershop, where my dad worked. Mm-hmm. Well, the whole thing backfired. And people came out in protest over this. We don't want our children learning about the evils of prostitution. And, oh, there was, you know, and of course, this backlash went practically worldwide. And it was down in the valley, and the press was coming up, and they were interviewing people, and there were so much publicity about it that it got kind of ugly in town. They had town meetings, and you know, how could the city council allow it? Well, Pete Casinelli, of course, is interviewed by Channel 13 or somebody, you know, and of course by this time he's realized this was a big mistake, and so he's in denial. No, did you know, Mr. Mayor, now, did you know this was going on? No, I didn't know this was going on. I had no idea this was, and I tell you the truth, I was astonished. Astonished by the whole thing. My mother was furious with my dad because here his Bobo's Barbershop had met, was a contributor to this. At that time, we were living up on Peak Hill, and I had a direct view down to where they put the plaque in, and I was married to Donna at the time, and I told her, I should go down and bust that out of the concrete because it's not going to stay there, you know, and, you know. And the next morning, it was gone.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was gone. And, you know, the backlash was just unbelievable.
And the five guys were all part of an organization, or they just did it on their own?
No, they were. There's a book written, The Last Days of the Great State of California. And in it, this guy describes this event, and he called them the Filthy Five.
Oh, okay.
And one was an investment broker by the name of Duff Chapman, who loved to do this kind of stuff. He wore a patch on his eye, and he was a part of the Clampers. Another one was a surveyor by the name of Gretzinger. One was, I think, a veterinarian and lived out in Plymouth somewhere. One was a county worker, Albert Victor, and one was a local attorney, Guy Reynolds.
Oh.
And so they had all gotten together and, you know, and decided that this would be something that they should do. Well, by this time in 68, as I mentioned before, the two houses that they refer to here were private residences. And I was teaching up at Jackson Junior High at the time, or Senior Elementary, they called it. And some of my students were living in there. Well, they had to leave. The family had to move out because the public was coming in there and banging on the windows and wanted to look in and see. And, I mean, they were really kind of harassing the people who were living there over all of this. So there was some unpleasantness associated with it. And of course, everybody wanted to talk about it, and it was a big thing. And you know, so you know, the reputation just kind of won't go away. The plaque went into hiding for many, 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 many years, and it's now, I think, it's at the museum. But there were some replicas made of it. Anyway.
That's good.
Yeah.
More local history.
Yeah, there's a lot of color.
Yeah, fun stuff. I did have another question, though. So when you first moved up here in this community, I talked to a gentleman that met a man that fought in World War One, and he was telling me about his different stories this guy went through. Do you have any of that? Did you know anybody that fought in World War One up here?
Not when you say did I know them, I knew of them.
Oh, okay.
When I was in school, I played the trumpet, mm-hmm. And I had the honor of being the bugler for the veterans' funerals. Mm. And John Begovich was the veteran service officer, so he would come up and take me out of high school, and take me to these cemeteries where they were burying veterans.
Right.
And a number of them were World War One veterans. Mm. And then I would play taps at their funeral services. John Begovich, you know, he liked my dad and he liked me, and we were all good friends. So anyway, when I graduated from high school, the veterans presented me with a watch for my service. as being the trumpeter for the funerals. And I did that for 2 or 3 years.
Oh, that's great.
So, yeah, I knew of them by that means. The other kind of thing that I feel privileged but and saddened at the same time, in 63, I was a relief driver for the ambulance.
Oh, okay.
And I got a call one morning that there was an emergency out at the Indian Reservation, out off of New York Ranch Road. And so I went out there, and I went in there, and there were two Indian ladies there. They were all kind of in a panic, and their father, Chief Alex, was in bed, and he was in poor condition. And I could tell, I could hear gurgling in his lungs, and I knew that he was getting fluid in his lungs, and gosh, I think he was like 94 at the time. And so I was, and at those days we drove the ambulance by ourselves, so I didn't have any assistance, so I had to have these ladies help me, and getting the gurney in there, and he was in a panic, and I tried to calm him down, and I had them talk to him, and he's going to be okay, we're going to get you help, you got to turn loose. But his hands were just glued to the bedstead, mm-hmm. hanging on. And finally we got him onto the gurney and strapped him in, and I'm thinking, you know, this is an emergency, I'll turn on the red lights, but I'm not going to turn on the siren, you know, because I didn't want to scare him any
sure.
more than he already was. And got him to the hospital, but he passed away shortly thereafter, like within hours.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the last of the real, the old-time Indian chiefs.
Mm-hmm.
And his name was Alex. And I'm guessing he was a Dalton, but I don't remember if he was or not.
Yeah.
But, you know, I felt, you know, that was kind of an honor to be able to help this family at that
sure,
time.
Sure, sure. I'm surprised there's only one of you that work it, because anymore it's always two.
Oh, yeah. Oh, gosh. I did it for a year, and I had to rely on bystanders to help. You know, I had advanced first aid training, and our instructions were stop the bleeding, stabilize them, and get them to the hospital. You know, and that's what we did. It was, reminds me of MASH, where meatball surgery. Well, basically that's all I was doing, was trying to get them to help as fast as I could.
So, did you meet any movie stars that came up through here or anything like that?
No, I didn't, but my dad did, and I saw him. You know, John Wayne was a frequent attender of the National Hotel, and I did see him. Another one that came up frequently was Charles Sterrett, known as the Durango. Was he? No, he wasn't the Durango. He was one of those, Charles Sterrett, he played one of those 30s and 40s cowboys.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe he was a Durango kid, I don't know. And Valvo's Barbershop was their main attraction, and I don't know how this all came about, but Frank Valvo seemed to have these connections. And so they were all big hunters, fishermen, and so I think he attracted a lot of them coming up hunting and fishing in the area. And, of course, there's always the famous rumor that John Wayne lost like $25,000 or $30,000 in a poker game to a local Ford dealer here.
Yeah, I heard that.
Yeah, I think there's probably truth to that. You know, and he stayed at the National Hotel at the time, which was the going place.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, there were movie stars, and you know, I don't know how many, but we heard about them. I never really got involved. I know Charles Sterrett was in the Kid Carson Mountain Man Parade a couple of times. He rode his horse.
The last week I was downtown, and they had a bunch of cars and trucks came right downtown the day of the Serbian Christmas.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I got out and fired shotguns and stuff. Do you remember as a kid the Serbian Christmas being
a really
big deal back then?
Oh, yeah. I remember that quite well. Because my parents were friends with a lot of the Serbians, and Ivo Vasiljevic worked in the barbershop. And so the Vasiljeviches, the Vakahaloviches, the Danaloviches, all in those days they all had open houses,
mm-hmm.
and of course you would go visit them, and it was an honor to go with them, go to their houses and have a drink and eat the food, you know, and celebrate Christmas. So Serbian Christmas was really, really big for me as a kid growing up. And I always said, you know, when I be an Italian, or my dad, when you're an Italian with a Serbian sounding name, you get to go to everybody's parties. You know? And I can remember that when my dad first joined the Italian Society, there was rumors going around, critical rumors saying, "No, what's that Italian doing now? They're letting a Serb in." You know. So anyway. But yeah, it was always a big deal, and of course, Dan Bukalovic, had the Wells Fargo Club, and it was always a big celebration at the club. At the Lions, when I was a member of the Lions, and Dan was too, we had a number of Serbs there. Every Lions luncheon that was on or near Serbian Christmas would be a big Serbian celebration. And of course, shooting off guns was the big thing.
Right.
And of course, a lot of students were Serbian were friends of mine who we went to school with.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's getting less and less and less. What happened is that these open houses, people were starting to abuse them. There were people that move in, and I'm not going to name names, but they would move up to the area, and you know, and they would be invited. Well, then they think this is a big deal, so they'd call their friends down in the valley or the Bay Area. Come on up, you know, guys. All this food and booze is free, you know? And so all these strangers were showing up, and so they started quit doing that because it wasn't what was supposed to do. So, and then the people were getting older. So then they decided that they would have a celebration out on North Main by invitation only. And several families, Serbian families, would get together and have their Christmas Eve celebration down there. And then you would be invited.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I had an invitation almost every year to that. But, you know, it was too bad because those open houses were so great.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah, they were really nice. And, you know, but there's always somebody that's going to take advantage and abuse it, not respect what it was all about.
There is a lot of culture up here.
Yeah, and of course, the Mother Church for the Serbian Orthodox religion is here in Jackson for North America. You know, so, you know, it has that.
That's huge.
It is huge. And, of course, you know, the other thing that's so neat about Amador County is, of course, it's a Miwok culture. And unfortunately, it's sad for me and you as well, because you're very sensitive to it, that the Miwok culture hasn't been more brought into prominence. And I think the casino is doing an awful lot towards that.
Oh, I do too. I think everything's moving in a good,
yeah,
positive direction.
My son, who worked for them, called me a couple months ago and said that they have a house up there that is vacant that they want to turn into a museum. And it wanted to know if I could help them with connections. And so I said, well, yeah, I can connect you with the California State Museum, you know, down by Sutter's Fort. And I know the archives has just tons of artifacts.
Yeah, I think they're all stored in McClellan Airport.
Now they're almost, and I want to go down there. We need to go down
there. All right, let's do it.
You know, I want to go down and see that. And, you know, now that it's, before it was never open to the public, and now it's open to the public.
That's what I've heard now.
So, yeah. So, you know, that's, and you've been a real help to me and understanding the Native American culture. And I make reference to you all the time.
Uh-oh. Well, thanks, Frank. Well, Frank, is there anything else?
Well, you know, I'm sure there is. You need to ask me more questions to trigger thoughts, but I think we've covered a lot of territory
today. Well, this is day one then.
Well,
thanks, Frank. I really appreciate this.
No problem. I enjoyed it. Thanks for asking.
No, it's not a problem.